This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, it's RÚV English Radio. My name's Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company today. It's a Monday, time for another episode of The Week in Iceland, and we shall take a look at what's been happening over the course of the last 7 days or thereabouts in the company today of my colleague here at RÚV, Árni Mathiasen. Hello, welcome.
Hi.
Welcome
back.
Great to be back. Good to have you in the seat once again. And it's been quite a week, really, particularly for our Brussels correspondent, Björn Malmqvist.
He's been burning the midnight oil.
He's been burning the oil all the way around the clock, I think it's fair to say, because of this story about the European Union and its decision to inflict protective tariffs on silicon in Iceland and in Norway. Now, these are countries which are in the EEA, but not the EU. And this is at the nub of the controversy, isn't it?
Yes, it was everybody thought it was just going to slide away. It was going to disappear, this matter, because it seemed that they were never able to, you know, really make a decision on this. But then suddenly it happened.
I think we should maybe just zoom out a little bit here, because there were similar tariffs on steel, I think, and Iceland and Norway were exempted because of their membership of the EEA, which is closely allied to, but not the European Union. And as you say, the mood music was that the same thing would happen with these silicon tariffs. The meeting to make the final decision was postponed, I think, twice. And that again felt, didn't it, as if the countries who would make the decision within the EU were going to be on Iceland's side. But it was a last-minute decision, it seems, from Ursula von der Leyen and others that swung this the other way.
It seemed that it swung the other way pretty suddenly.
Yes.
It was probably something like that that happened. Mm. Because all of a sudden they had the majority, so they went for it. And there was a lot of surprise here. People were really, really surprised.
Yeah. Well, I was here in the newsroom when the news broke, surprise is absolutely the right word to use.
Absolutely. Nobody believed that this could happen.
Yeah.
Because it runs counter to the EEA agreement.
Yeah.
And it does in a way, but there is this provision that if there's a great danger to national security or a disaster area in some country, they are allowed to do this. Mm. So that's the thing they used.
So this is about protecting silicon markets in EU countries.
Yeah, it's protecting industry that's in manufacturing in these countries because they weren't able to manufacture and sell for the same price as Iceland and Norway can, because energy is so much cheaper here and also in Norway.
But it seems that the EU's ended up with the worst of all worlds, because it has been at pains to point out to Iceland, I don't know whether it has to Norway to the same extent, but certainly to Iceland, to say, look, don't worry about it, because these tariffs have got lots of exemptions within them that mean that you're not going to be affected.
Yeah.
So we've ended up in a situation where everyone is really cross with the EU because of this breach of principle, but the EU has made all these changes that will mean that the tariffs may not have any effect anyway. Yeah.
What I find interesting is that the way politicians have approached this, because we now have a coalition of parties that were very anxious or eager even to join the EU.
Two definitely are.
One is, more or less on the fence. Mm. But their approach to this has been very, very, they've been doing this very quietly. They don't want to make any big declarations or express anger or dismay and so on. So nobody wants to spend the political capital in advocating for EU accession. That's just the way things are here. Because people know if we decide to we want to bring Iceland into the EU, there will be such a fight, such a vicious fight, that they're trying to stay out of it and trying to keep people, we will sort this out. We'll sort this out. Everything's going to be okay.
But in 2027 or by 2027, those coalition government parties have pledged to have a referendum, not on EU membership technically, but on resuming those accession talks.
Yeah. That's the big thing. And if they have this fight now, they're undermining that. So that's why they're really going really carefully. But then again, people around me, and nobody's talking about this in the pool, in the hot pot of the swimming pool. Nobody's talking about this. Yeah. people, I've been asking people about this, and nobody is worried, except, of course, people in the north, Húsavík.
Yes.
And in Hvalfjörður also.
Is it changing minds then on the EU question?
I'm not sure. I think people don't really connect with the story. This is an extremely important story for the people affected. Because there's loads of jobs that will be lost, and in small villages, in villages that are losing lots of jobs. So there's an effect, of course. Everyone that loses a job means that two other people lose a job,
yes,
or lose income and so on.
But are they losing jobs because of these tariffs?
Yes, they will. Yeah,
they will.
Yeah,
because already there's a situation, yes, isn't there, with the plant in Bakki in the north of Iceland.
They were hoping to be able to get from under that and resume production, but now it won't be this year and probably not the next year.
I am puzzled by what the EU has done, simply because, and we talked about this on the show last week, the EU presumably would quite like Iceland to join its union at some point. And this, it seems to me, maybe from what you're saying, it's overstated, but it seems to me that this is a very strange decision if you're trying to get people in Iceland on your side, as far as that is concerned. Yeah.
But then again, the countries in the EU, each single one of those countries has its own political problems,
yes,
and that's what's going on. They're not looking at the big picture.
No.
They're just solving something, some problem that they're dealing with at this moment.
And it is those individual countries, yes, that had this vote here. Now, they might have been persuaded to go a particular, yeah, way by Ursula von der Leyen, but nonetheless, it were the individual countries that had the decision. I've heard an argument, I haven't heard it very much, I wouldn't claim it's a majority view, but some people have said that, of course, if Iceland was in the EU, then by definition, these tariffs wouldn't apply, and it's a reason for actually being in the club rather than outside. Like I say, it's not a view I've heard very often or very much, but it is being expressed.
I've seen it expressed. I've seen it expressed in printing as well. I know I've seen it expressed on Facebook, people saying if we were members of the EU, this wouldn't be a problem at all.
Hmm.
So, yeah, but that's not discussed widely, though.
No.
As you say, I haven't seen it discussed widely, even if I see it in comments on and Facebook and,
yes,
and social media.
And again, those parties who are keen for Iceland to join the EU, or at least to resume those accession talks, they're not making that case loudly,
no,
either.
Exactly,
they're not,
yes,
making any case, as you
they're
say.
They're not making any case because they don't want this to blow up.
Yes. Well, political capital is going to have to be spent one way or the other around the time of the referendum. I'm originally from a country which allows me to confirm that when you ask people about European membership, a lot of capital does get spent.
Yeah.
It's a politically expensive conversation to have, whichever side you happen to be on.
Extremely, yes.
And that is the story then of the tariffs, or at least the protective tariffs, we could call them, on silicon. There is still a hope, I believe, isn't there, expressed by politicians, not least the Prime Minister, that if this can be reversed in some way, she wants it to be. But it feels like it's pretty settled now.
It feels like it's not going to happen for a while.
Hmm. Okay. Let's turn to Grindavík. Executives at HS Vetur, which is the water company, the water and power company, and the Blue Lagoon, received a request from the Ministry of Finance for an expert assessment on the cost of the defensive operations around Grindavík. Now, we talk about these defensive walls that have been built, the vast and incredible and hugely successful effort there has been to protect not just the Blue Lagoon and the power station, but the town of Grindavík as well, basically by building up these walls of earth and rock. Quite incredible to watch, as we have over the last couple of years. It seems as if the Blue Lagoon and also the owners of the power station are surprised that they might now be asked to contribute financially to this.
I think everybody was surprised, but a lot of people think it should be done. When they were building these earthworks to save the Blue Lagoon when the eruption was going on, there was a lot of discussion that why are we spending all this money to save a private company? They should just do it themselves.
But wasn't the plan to try to save the power station?
The power station was the big thing, yeah.
Yes,
and of course, the Blue Lagoon is so close to the power station.
It only exists because of the power station.
because it's spillwater from the power station.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's so close that you couldn't say, okay, we're just going to let the Blue Lagoon go, and we'll save the power station.
You might as well have built.
They're inextricably linked. So you can't really do that. But a lot of people feel that there was a lot of discussion about, and also the power station is owned in part by foreign investors.
Mm.
So there was also a lot of discussion, and just let them burn is what people are saying. Why should we save them? Saving Grindavik is something that everyone is in agreement. You know, everyone thinks should be done. Saving normal homes and people, let's do it. Private companies, there's a lot of discussion because it's so expensive.
But there's a big difference in the consequences of those two things burning down, isn't there?
So yes,
if the Blue Lagoon
is.
Burns down, obviously that's very bad for tourists, and there's some measurable impact on the economy. If the power station goes, then 25,000 people don't afford
water. Yes, it's going to be a big impact for a lot of people. And also, so there's also this other thing that the Blue Lagoon is it's a luxury thing.
Yes.
It's very expensive to go there. And they make a lot of money. They make a huge amount of money. And they've been building lagoons. They're starting to build lagoons around the country.
Mm.
So to the normal Icelander, they're this huge capitalist company which has a lot of money. Why should we save them?
Yeah.
Is what people think. But as you mentioned, you can't really save only one and not the other.
It would have been quite churlish, wouldn't it, if you were building those walls to stop it before it got to the
well, if you look at how things are there, the landscape there, you just can't do it.
You couldn't do it anyway.
No, because
the two units are so close to each other.
Yes.
So where does this go then? Because it opens up a wider conversation, I guess, about to what extent the Icelandic taxpayer, wherever they happen to live in Iceland, should be responsible for saving infrastructure and people in Grindavik.
Well, it's not just only because of volcanic activity. Because in the north and in the west fjords, a lot of money has been spent in building berms to divert avalanches.
Yes, yes.
Away from the city and away from towns. Mm. A lot of money has been spent on that over the years. And nobody has mentioned at any time why are we spending money doing this, because it's so obvious to do it. And when they are saving the town, they're saving the fish factory as well.
Yes.
And a lot of loads of companies there. So that it's not been... It was a surprising thing that this was mentioned, that they mentioned that maybe the Blue Lagoon and the power station should contribute to costs.
Yeah.
It was, because it's never been done. Everybody has always been, if you're saving the fish factory, you're saving jobs for people to live in the town. So you're saving the town at the same time.
And in a small country like Iceland, small in terms of population, everything is connected. So if you help one bit, you're bound to be helping another
bit of the economy
or of society in some way. And I mean, it's always felt to me that at a local level, even when Grindavik was going through the worst of those difficulties, and when we had some of those hot water pipes being affected by the lava, neighbouring municipalities, for example, would open up their swimming pools for free and say, come along and use our showers and use our hot water. So, you know, at a local level, as I say, there's a willingness to cooperate and help people out, isn't there?
You don't see at all the discussion that we shouldn't be spending money to keep these places alive, even if occasionally you would encounter it. It's not a common thing.
Mm.
It's not a common. And if you started discussing it in this way in this pool, where everybody goes to talk about things, people would not be very happy.
Mm. If you were to suggest that we shouldn't all collectively assist. Yeah, okay. Let's turn to a success story in Iceland, which is that within the last sort of 25 years, something or thereabouts, something that used to be a huge problem, teen drinking, has been very largely eradicated. Teen drinking used to be something that, before we were in Iceland, you would see quite a lot. Though I was telling you a few moments ago, I'll always remember one of our first ever trips in the late 1990s, filling up with petrol in Eylstadir. As we were pulling away, we saw a guy who must have been 14 or 15 at most, with a bottle of vodka in his hand in the middle of the day, absolutely blind drunk. Now, that is something we just don't see anymore. There is some controversy, though, in the last week, isn't there, about whether teen drinking is actually rising again. At the start of the week, a story suggested it was.
Yes, there was a story in Morgenbladet, the daily newspaper in Morgenbladet, and also on their website, mbl.is, that teen drinking has had increased, Whereas the minister for health, the health minister, he insisted that it hadn't increased because he had a new report, I think generated a couple of months ago, which suggested that it had not been increasing at all. So there was, it's been a spat between Morgenblad and the minister, which unseemly spat, if I can say so. But the thing is, generally speaking, people agree on it having increased.
Mm. Because our report here at RUV was about a survey of youth centre staff who had all said, or not all said, but enough of them for it to be significant, had said that they had noticed this being a problem beginning to rise.
I think the report the minister was quoting was a survey of children.
This was a different report. So yes, we're talking about two different reports. Yes, so there is some evidence maybe then from the youth centre worker report that they've noticed.
Yeah, but my feeling is, and generally I think it has increased. It has definitely increased, yes. Yeah. It hasn't reached the same level as it had before, but it has increased. And there's also been this surge of companies selling alcohol online.
Yes.
Which has been very controversial, help, because it's technically it is illegal, and there have been some charges laid where it has been referred to the police. But as the Minister of Justice was from the Independence Party, and the Independence Party, which is right of centre, they want to legalise selling alcohol in shops, generally.
And we should say, of course, if you don't know, that you can only buy it in a shop called Vinbuthen, which is a state alcohol monopoly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't; it's not open on Sundays, and if you don't get there when the shop's open, then you can't buy alcohol.
So historically, the Sjálvstæðisflokkur, the Independence Party, has been very eager to open for this, for sales of alcohol, in just like any commodity. Mm. And the Minister of Justice was from the Independence Party, and he more or less stopped the investigation.
This is the previous government.
Yes, the previous government. So it never was investigated, really. Now there's a new government, and we have a new Minister of Justice, and that Minister of Justice is also more or less would like for alcohol to be sold in shops in general. It's not as blatant, so to speak, but it more or less she has agreed to that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of inertia in the system in doing something about these sales. So a lot of you can go online, you can buy alcohol, and they will drive it to you, or you can come and pick it up.
Yeah, but I mean, 13-year-olds aren't doing that, are they?
No. Yeah. But the thing is, if you're old enough to do it, the people working there are close to the same age as the people buying, so they're more relaxed than you would be if you're older. Loads of loopholes naturally occurring loopholes. It's like if you're selling alcohol in the corner store, and you have a young person working there because it's the cheap staff, and someone comes in who's close to their age or is in the same school and so on, he will sell them alcohol.
Yes.
That's the way it happened. And that's the same thing that's happening. And you can go and pick it up, or they will drive it home to you.
So, but when it stopped, when Iceland had this huge success in stopping
It was a concerted effort.
Yeah, it wasn't just about making alcohol more difficult.
Exactly, yes. It was a concerted effort in increasing things, in concerted effort between municipalities and parents, to create more opportunities for children to do stuff.
Other things,
yes. It's like they spend a lot of money on changing the we had, let's take football as an example. Young people were playing football and they were training for football, but they had poor resources and they had poor trainers and so on. So there was money spent in that, building the facilities, hiring trainers, accredited trainers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money was spending things like that. So the kids had lots more to do, which means they had a more structured environment, which means they spent less time drinking. And
And a lot of that is really good stuff to do anyway, isn't it? It's really important for all kinds of reasons. Yeah. But it had this very specific effect.
It had this effect almost immediately.
Yeah. And I wonder what the solution is this time then, if indeed there is a problem or anything like the scale.
Well, there has been, we have been going through austerity. We saw what austerity more or less destroyed the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah, more or less. Reading about life in the cities in the UK, loads of cities around the UK, it's terrible. And that's austerity. And we had a bit of austerity here, which has decimated youth services, and also health services have been having a hard time, and so on. So that, you know, everything changes. If you change the environment kids are growing up in, it causes problems in the long run.
Yes. I'm sure, of course, I should just say that there are people in the UK, not necessarily myself, but there are perhaps people in the UK who would say that austerity was necessary. And
I was reading a book called Ghost Signs, which was about a person, a musician actually, and a writer, who was a volunteer. During COVID, he was taking food to people, the food distribution and drug, and helping to pick up drugs for them. He was a volunteer, and there was a team of volunteers driving trucks. I can't remember, it was somewhere in the Midlands. And the poverty he was describing, it was so terrible. That I loads of time I just had to stop and say, okay, now I have to read something pleasant for a while before I can keep reading. So, and that's Brexit for you.
Well, one of the reasons that I and my partner are here in Iceland is that we love the place and have done for years and years and years. And, you know, in many ways, it's not the UK. But one of the very many things I love about Iceland is that we don't faff around with the clocks twice a year in a futile attempt to create more daylight. Now, we talked about this last week, but the conversation extends into a second week because Alma Muller, who's the Minister of Health, suggests that Icelanders could sleep better if the country changed its time zone. Now, what she's talking about and what the sleep scientist, whose name is Erla Björnsdóttir, is also suggesting, just to be clear on this, because there was some confusion in the comments for the second week in a row, is moving the clocks back once by 1 hour to UTC or GMT minus one, not changing them twice a year, but saying we're in the wrong time zone, we'll make one switch of 1 hour and then the clocks will be fine. That is what the Minister of Health thinks would be a good idea.
Yeah.
And to say that there has been some controversy about this would be to understate.
This has been controversial for as long as I remember. Well, when I was a kid, we switched twice a year.
Yeah. Okay, so that used to happen.
Yeah, it used to happen, yeah. But then it was decided that it was stupid, which it is.
It is.
And they decided to pin it on this, you know, not to have it UTC minus one, just to have it UTC.
Which is the same as GMT.
Which is the same as GMT, yeah. And this has been, you know, this comes up now and again. it becomes a big crescendo of discussion and then it just fades away.
It would be ironic if it came up twice a year, wouldn't it? that would be
very interesting, yeah. So I don't know if it's going to happen now, but she is, of course, she is in government. And she is the first person actually in government as a minister who has suggested this, because suggestions have come from MPs. For loads of times.
And there is a petition from this sleep scientist, which at the time of writing had about 7,000 signatures. Yeah. Quite a lot in a country like Iceland, maybe more by now. But you're right, it's the first time that a minister has actually said this is a good idea. Yeah. I'm just checking on my watch to see exactly when the sunrise and sunset is today. So it's the 24th of November. Sunrise tomorrow is at 25 past 10 in the morning. And sunset is at 2 minutes past four in the afternoon.
The thing that people are thinking about is getting more light earlier in the day. During the winter, that's obviously not going to help you because you're going to go to work in the dark anyway.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so not extreme gonna change anyway. Anything.
But what the last time we went through this discussion, which then petered out, was that then a lot of people were pointing out because the kids go to school in the dark in the morning. They would go to school in the dark anyway.
Yep.
But when they come home by themselves, they would lose light because we're going to shift darkness further up in the day.
Yes, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, yes. So instead of kids coming home while it's more or less daylight out, loads of them would be coming home when it's darker outside, which would be worse for them. That was the big argument at the time, which everybody said, oh, yeah, okay, I hadn't thought about it this way. Yeah, let's just keep it as it is.
So that was an argument for not changing the clocks anymore. Yes. Because if you were to move back, let's get this the wrong way around, but let me see. So if at the height of winter, sun sets about 3 o'clock, that would then be 2 o'clock.
Yes.
Wouldn't it?
Yes. So it would be darker earlier in the day, which means that the kids would go to school in the dark and they would come home in the dark.
Yeah, because the school doesn't start early enough or late enough.
Or late enough, for them to benefit.
So I wonder what will happen with this. And it's the same anywhere, actually. If you say to people, should we change whatever system we have as far as the clocks?
It's going to be a heated discussion, I'm sure. But now Alma has been talking about having a plebiscite. People should vote on this.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that will come out.
Another all referendum. Bets off. Yeah, well, as we've touched on, referenda tend to pick up, don't they, the feelings about whatever the government is doing at the time. So you might ask that question, you might get an answer to a totally different question, depending when it happens. Who knows? But it is just a fact of geography that Iceland is so far north that during the summer it's incredibly bright most of the time. During the winter, it's very dark most of the time. And you don't really shift that, do you, fundamentally, by moving the clocks either way?
Unless you move it a lot.
Unless you move it a lot, but then you create the problem at the other end of the day, I suppose, don't you? So we'll see what happens with that. Let's celebrate some good news. Let's put 60 candles on the cake for Björk, who is an Icelandic icon, and unbelievably, she is that age. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, the usual way, I guess.
But it doesn't seem that long, does it? Because it doesn't seem that she's that old, is what I should say. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about a new book that's been published detailing the history of Icelandic pop, and we were talking about Birthday being released and Sugar and the Sugar Cubes being a successful band for the first time. And wow, to think that she's now 60 is incredible.
Yeah, it's 39 years since Birthday was released. So,
yeah, it must be.
Yeah. So I think you shouldn't be surprised that she's 60.
No, I'm surprised that she's not still 21, I guess.
Yeah.
It's what I'm surprised
about. But as you mentioned, she's Björk has been controversial here throughout the years because her music, her music isn't always entertaining, so to speak. It demands a lot from you. But she was very popular. I mean, the album where she played old Icelandic songs with the jazz band, Glinglo, was hugely successful here. The Sugar Cubes were popular here, but never really that popular because they sang in English and they were more of alternative rock. So she has never been popular, really, really popular.
In Iceland.
Yeah. But she has been iconic for a very, very long time.
What's interesting as well, and this relates to, I guess, anyone who you might consider, if you're listening outside of Iceland, to be an Icelandic celebrity. There's not really the same concept of celebrity in Iceland. So she's able to go to the pool. She's able to go to her local supermarket.
If you live in the West End, you could meet her buying food in Melabudin or meet her at the pool. Or if you're hanging out downtown, she would maybe be DJing or just dancing.
Yes.
There was the story about her just recently. There was a musician who saw her and was very starstruck, and he came up to her and he said, can I have a picture of us? And she said, can't you see I'm dancing? people just leave her alone, more or less.
And that's because local people are just not interested,
for one thing. Yes.
And secondly, she does perfectly reasonably, as far as I'm concerned, request that when she's shopping or in the pool or dancing, that she's not bothered.
Yeah, and more or less she isn't. But she's been she's been iconic, and she's been incredibly important for the Icelandic music scene, as a something to aspire to, because she always does what she wants to do. She always has control of everything herself. She produces her music, more or less everything.
And as we discussed actually on that program, that's a really important point, because she has been at pains to point out that women are not just singers. Yes. Basically, they're songwriters and producers too.
And also, one thing that people maybe don't know is that her band, Sugar Cubes, and the people that were with her in the band, they formed this company called Bad Taste, which has been releasing records and publishing books throughout the years. Mm. And a lot of these records do not sell well with younger bands, do not sell well, but Bad Taste pays, keeps on doing it. So they've been very supportive in a direct way in the Icelandic music scene,
yes,
and literary scene over the years.
And they still have a shop in Hverfisgata,
they still have a shop in Hverfisgata where you can go and buy some music,
Recommend doing.
Or have a coffee upstairs.
Yes, and if you go through to the upstairs bit, then you can sit in the square, can't
you? Yes, exactly,
In the centre of Reykjavik. Yeah. And that is the same company.
That's the same company.
That set up the label.
Taste or Smekklesa in Icelandic.
Yes, so definitely worth investigating if you're here in town. And we would say, til hamingju.
Yeah, til hamingju með ammalið.
To Björk, who has just turned 60.
Yeah.
One final story that's caught my eye, and it's quite sad in a way. The lighthouse,
Gjögurtá,
which used to sit clinging to the cliff, is no more. It has fallen into the sea and its concrete foundations have been discovered. Yeah. Now, when you look at a photo of this zoomed out as to where the lighthouse was, it was a tiny little thing clinging on for dear life, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it was. But it wasn't when it went up. It wasn't that bad. But the erosion has really, really, yeah.
It has taken it. Now, there's a photo here that I'm looking at of when it did exist. And you can see there that it's manacled. It's chained
on. It was leaning over, yeah.
To the side of the cliff. Yeah. What are the consequences of this then? Well, are ships now in danger?
Ships could potentially be in danger, yes. So they're going to put something up there. But that won't be for a while.
They're not in danger from the foundations.
No.
In danger from the lack of light.
Yeah, they're in danger there because there are skerries.
Yes.
Just off the coast.
Yes. And, I mean, obviously this wasn't a manned lighthouse. I'm not sure you could even fit inside it and stand up anyway, you? But this was an automated lighthouse. The fact that it was maintained and the fact that it was used indicates there was a need for it.
It is actually important, yes.
Yeah. And I wonder how it'll be replaced then.
They're going to put up another one, a bit more inland, which means that it would have to be taller.
Yeah, because again, looking at the photo here, it was some considerable distance down from what looks like a very, very steep cliff.
Yeah.
Is the risk that if you just put it on top of the cliff, it's too high up?
It's too high up then, yes.
And ships can't see it?
Yeah.
Gosh, okay. Well, I don't fancy being on the construction team that has to plan and install this new lighthouse. Will there be a competition maybe for the design of it?
That would be very nice, but probably not.
Well, sad news then that this lighthouse has fallen away. How long was it there for then? Do we know? Because it doesn't. It looks quite modern. It looks like it's not been there for sort of 200 years.
Well, there was a lighthouse there before.
Right.
So this was a replacement.
This was already a replacement.
Yes.
Okay. How sad. There was a risk in the summer, a report in the summer, there was a risk of this collapsing, and so it has come to pass. So attention all shipping, if you're in that part of the country. Árni, thank you very much indeed. We shall talk again, another episode of The Week in Iceland before too long. And of course, a daily show from Rúv English Radio online here every day. This is Rúv English Radio. My name's Darren Adam, and you can get in touch anytime. We're english@ruv.is.
There is more from Rúv English with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. Rúv English Radio is a daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, Rúv.